Virginia. Paul's visiting for a couple days. He's an expert in beta ansatz, supersymmetry, conformal field theory. But he's also an accomplished musician. Well, this is his other thing. As far as I understand, he toured with a Christian rock band in the 80s for a while. So he'll answer questions about that after his talk. Order and spin systems.
That was not the high point of my musical career. Great to say. Well, thank you, Roger. It's great to be here. So since this audience, I was told, would maybe wide ranges in both backgrounds and in levels of familiarity. So I decided the first sort of half or so, maybe first third of the talk is pretty much colloquium level. So I hope everybody does that. I apologize to the experts. But I'm also going to remind people of things that are well known to sort of traditional meaning people over 40 condensed matter circles, but maybe even some of the young'uns have moved on to some other stuff. So maybe that, hopefully everyone will not fall asleep in that part. And then we'll get a little more complicated, but I think, as Roger says, I do a lot of different stuff. So I try to kind of keep things at a global level as much as possible. So this is sort of an overview talk. So first question, so the title was topological order and spin systems, so probably know what a spin system is, but you may not know what topological order is, and it's actually a little bit of a confused concept because the definitions that are good for calculational purposes tend to be conceptually not very clear, and the conceptually clear ones are actually not that useful for computational purposes. My favorite one, and I think this one works for all times, I don't think there's any counterexamples, is to say when you have a physical system, it's topologically ordered if the number of ground states of the system depends on the genus of the surface. So already if he's talking about genus is why the word topology comes in. But that sounds very abstract, but if you think of it from the point of view of a condensed matter physicist, that's a very bizarre thing if it were to depend on the genus. Because if in condensed matter, we always talk about order, so stuff lines up, a bunch of spins, magnetic moments points in the same direction. So that's not going to care about the genus of a surface, whether you're on a torus or whether you're on a sphere. I mean, they all line up. They all just point in the same direction. There's nothing fancy there. And of course, if it's disordered, if there's no order like that, again, who cares? They're pointing every which way. They don't care then about whether you're on a torus or a sphere. But these topological error phases, and I'll be more specific very soon, but these are sensitive to this. And the reason they're sensitive is because the key word up there is non-local. There's sort of order going on, but you have to look at long distances to see the kind of order it is. So there is order, but you're not going to see it just by looking at short distances. You're only going to see it by looking at long distances. And Xiaogang Wen, who many of you know, was the first person to think about this when trying to understand what's the order in the quantum Hall effect. And how do you understand order there? And this turned out to be the natural way of doing it. So what I said about non-local, so a kind of model, the simplest kind of model that has topological order, I should say, is if your degrees of freedom aren't just spins, but they're loops. And we'll discuss in general how to get loops from spins in a little while. But for now, just think of loops. And so these can be topological order because, of course, if your ground state allows these long loops to exist, if you happen to be there, so that's more technically said, they're deconfined, you can let these things spread out, well, then you can have stuff that wraps around one of the cycles of a torus or a cylinder. And thus, it might be, then if you have one ground state that does have something looped around a cylinder and another one that doesn't, well, then that's two ground states. But that'll be sensitive to what genus you're on, because then you can wrap around or not wrap around. If you're on the sphere, there's nothing topologically non-trivial about a sphere. So that's an example of the kind of thing. So that's very abstract, but I'm gonna explain specific examples where you're gonna get that sort of behavior. And so before I give you some details, though, let me explain why we care. It's just really cool. In particular, you get fractionalization, and so you get the quasi-particle system, so the excitations of the system have quantum numbers that aren't present in the constituents of the systems. That's a very bizarre fact. So for example, in the fractional quantum Hall effect, it's made up of electrons. So we'll say that's charge one. But if you look at the excitations of the system, they can have fractions of a charge, say charge a third. Now, in the whole universe, we know we have integer number of electrons. So that says that you can't have just one of these one-third excitations you've had. You have to have three, but you can move those three very far away, at least very far away in your very small sample. And so that's what we mean by fractionalization. Another example I'll give, and more specifically, is called spin-charge separation. And I'll say, I'll explain more precisely what that is. And the killer app for this that's proposed, and something that a number of people in the room have been involved with, including me, is you can actually, when you have these fractional excitations, you can get something even stranger, which they're called anions. And so when you take one around another one, so we have bosons and fermions, you know, you take one around each other, they can, the wave function can pick up a sign. But in 2+1 dimensions, so two spatial dimensions one time, you can actually do much more complicated things. You can actually change state of the system. If you have a degenerate ground states, just like I described in this topological order case, you could then do what people now call topological quantum computation. And thus, it would be robust against coherence. Potentially robust against decoherence. So the fact that, like I said, the fact that we get these multiple ground states in a topologically ordered system means that you can do, imagine things like this happening in these sorts of systems. So that's a long story, and I'm only going to tell you a little bit part of it. But let me just, again, before part of the general remarks, say, okay, how do we make progress? Because necessarily for these problems to be interesting, they have to be strongly coupled. I'm not going to make a charged third object out of a bunch of charged one objects unless they're really interacting strongly and funny stuff happens. And so what we need to do here then is use some fancier techniques to study these things. Ben, that's for the purpose of the talk today. I'm going to tell you about some of these techniques that can be used in a particular problem. And so, you know, field theory is lingua franca for many theoretical physicists. So that's maybe not a surprise. Integrability is something that is a specialized technique that works in some low-dimensional systems, and I'll explain here how that works. Okay, so this slide is mostly to show off on how impressive my colleagues and all the people working in this field, all the amazingly complicated and subtle things we do. So these are a bunch of physical systems, and when I say physical systems, I guess all of these, maybe not that one, all these other ones at least have probably been seen in nature. And then these are all these fancy theories that we use to describe them. So just be impressed. There's a lot of cool buzzwords. But the one I'm going to talk about today is this called RVB model and a few variations on this. And I will tell you what RVB means if you don't know already. A physical motivation I won't say much about, but there's some reports of these interesting phases called spin liquids, and I'll at least indicate what that means. Okay, so now let's get a little more concrete, although I still very general level, and these are some basic ideas that I've actually been in the literature for a long time. Anderson proposed this RVB wave function nearly 40 years ago, and then the ideas that I'm about to describe were thought of by, Kittleson, Roxar, and Safna, I guess, in the late 80s. So these are ideas that have been around a while. They came up in the context of HiTC, which was probably the wrong place to think about them, and that took a long time and a lot of prejudice to overcome because they were probably the wrong ideas for HiTC, but they're the right ideas for other physics. And so that shows maybe if you have a beautiful idea, you should just follow it and not worry about the experiment that week at any rate, maybe at some point. All right, so here, okay, so we got some lattice. We have a spin model. So that just means you pin an electron to each side of the lattice, and don't have to worry about charge because they're not moving. But what they can do is flip. And so they've got interactions, and I'm not writing down a Hamiltonian yet, but what I'm going to do is talk about a wave function. And in condensed matter physics these days, we talk a lot about wave functions. And so let's think about the kinds of wave functions you can have. Well, so a valence bond is just a fancy name for saying we've got electron here, a spin. Let's just call them spins. We've got a spin here, another spin there, their spin a half, and of course they can form a singlet state. And so this is just now my pictorial notation. I draw a line between the two. And I'll call this line a dimer a lot. So let's just call it now a dimer. More technically, you should call it a valence bond. And it's just a spin singlet. I didn't even bother to normalize it. But that's all that means. And so, for example, this is one particular state of this magnet. But, you know, one among many. But what the resonating valence bond state is now a linear superposition of all such these dimer or valence bond configurations. And that was what Anderson proposed thinking about a long time ago. So it's a peculiar state. So it's a very quantum state because it's a sum over all these states. So each one state is kind of a nice state, and you can line up these dimers. That would be called a valence bond order state. But instead, the resonating valence bond state is just a sum over all of them. And you can just give all the coefficients equal, whether they're equal or have differ slightly doesn't really matter. What's important is they're all there. And so why one might want to look at this is because it's a natural setting for understanding what people call spin charge separation. So it's a specific kind of these fractionalized excitations. So there's a nice cartoon picture. Oh, actually, it's not even really a cartoon. It's the reality, which Kibbles and Rockstar and Sethna explained a long time ago, and how you would get this in if you had a system whose RVB, whose ground state was this RVB state. That's a hard part, and we're going to talk about how to do that. But let's just pretend that we've got that as a state. Okay, so this is that's a state, but remember, our ground state is the sum over all of them. So now let's look not at the ground state, but an excited state. So what we do is we break one bond. Okay, so this guy isn't paired with anybody, and that guy's not paired with anybody. Well, if the ground state is the sum over everything, now we take this state here. Okay, we've broken only one bond. Okay, so now that's, say, in a spin triplet phase. But we haven't changed the charge any. We've got the same exact charge we've got before. And if the ground state really just lets these guys go anywhere, well, there's no particular energy for this guy to move over here. So I can think of this guy as its own quasi-particle. But this state has spin 1, but charge 0. So I can move these things miles away from each other. And so then the natural thing to think about is this particle, this quasi-particle, the quasi-particle has spin 1/2, but charge 0. So we've separated the spin and charge. The spin of the excitation is 1/2, but the charge is 0. And whereas the electrons are spin 1/2, charge 1/2, charge 1, I guess. And likewise, that's called a spin on, and then there's a hole on, which is the same thing. So now we just pull an electron out. Okay, well, now the overall spin state is still spin 0. Everything that's there is in a singlet, so the overall spin has to be 0. But we've pulled out 2 electrons. So I guess the charge, well, is minus 2e or 2e, depending on whether I define e to be positive or negative. And so again, if we can move these apart far away, well, then each of these has spin 0 but charge e. So we split, prosaically, we have split the electron into a charge, a hole on and a spin on. And this sounds crazy, but this is actually more or less what happens in an ordinary boring superconductor, because you make excitations inside a superconductor, but their charge is screened, but their spin is not. So they move around in the interior. The charge excitations are stuck on the edge, basically, but the spin can move around in the middle. So the electrons, it has a cloud around it, if you wish, so the charge is screened. So effectively, it's chargeless. And so this is just actually a simpler version of what really goes on in a superconductor. Okay, and for if any of you know conformal field theory, which I don't know if that's the right crowd, this has a well-known, in that context, version, which they don't call spin-charge separation. They would call it non-abelian bosonization. But okay, there's a few you may know that. That slide was for that. All right, so now we want to do this. Those were pictures. I kept saying, if we can do this, if we can do that, then we have this cool physics. But now how do we find a real model? And so that's what, then we can worry about whether you can see it in an experiment. But before we can do an experiment, let's even find a model where we can make this happen. And so the spin problem is really hard. We're going to come back to that, the problem I described. But you can make a lot of progress by studying a simpler version of this problem. And this is what Rockstar and Kibbleson, again, proposed a long time ago, more than 20 years ago. They said, instead of studying spins, let's study dimers. So let's just take one of these pictures. Where are we going? And instead of thinking of this as a spin singlet, so there's really an electron there and another electron there, and they're forming the singlet, let's just take the dimer to be a degree of freedom. That's my now Hilbert space is comprised just of all possible dimer configurations. That's a smaller Hilbert space than the full thing, which would be 2 to the n dimensional for n sites.
But it's a perfectly well-defined Hilbert space. And moreover, you make something that's not true in the spin model. You make different dimer configurations orthogonal. So each different dimer configuration write down, it's an element, basis element of the Hilbert space, and they're orthogonal. Well, I'll write down later what the actual answer is if we think of these as spins. This is a perfectly well-defined quantum model. Whether or not it has to do with any reality, you can worry about, but perfectly well-defined quantum models. Quantum dimers. Each dimer configuration is a basis element of the Hilbert space, and it's orthogonal to any other one. And so now what Roxburgh and Kivelson did is constructed a Hamiltonian that has this RVB state as its ground state in when the dimers are the degrees of freedom. And so to make contact with what I said at the very beginning, so why this has to do with spin charge separation. So again, so I mentioned this about loops. Okay, these are dimers, not loops, but you can easily turn dimers into loops. So you just pick some reference configuration. It doesn't matter which one. Let's pick that one. So this is just a particular configuration of dimers. And then you lay it on top of the whatever your dimer configuration is. And so notice these things form closed loops then. It's because of the rule that each dimer touches, you know, just one site and then goes to just one other site. And then these things form closed loops, including if you call this thing a closed loop. It's sort of two dimers on top of each other. So if I call that a loop too, then it forms closed loops. So again, then now all that cool stuff I mentioned at the beginning perhaps can come into play. So that's just rewriting what I said. That's the same picture as before. And again, for experts who know a little bit about lattice gauge theory, you can treat these as Ising domain walls, or these are Wilson loops in the Z2 gauge theory. And then the interesting thing to get the excitations, the things that are going to have this funny behavior, you would basically have a loop end. So that's an excitation. But then to keep it zero energy, it would have to be attached to a string. So that's a quick version. There's some other fancy stuff you can get. I can explain how to get. There's analogs of the what I call the hole on and the spin on here. So I said the analog of this, the hole on, is just to have something that's not paired. That's basically exactly the same as before. So you physically put a hole in the system. So there's a site that has no dimer on it. And the analog of the spin on is a little bit more complicated. You have to draw a string and you weight it by minus one of the number of dimers crossed. People now call that a vison because that's, I don't know, someone thought it sounded cooler at some point. But the upshot, why this is interesting, if you take one of these around the other, is if you make one of these excitations the other and you take them around each other, even though everything in this theory I defined to begin was bosonic, right? They're just dimers. They're not. There's no electrons. There's no nothing other than these dimers. If I do this, I take one around each other, and then I get a minus sign. And so that's the cool part. That's the example of we're making sort of a mutual fermion. They're not individually fermions, they're bosons. You take one around, you take a hole around a hole, nothing happens because they're just holes. But if I take a hole around one of these things, because this has a string, that has a string, then you get this minus sign. So I didn't do this calculation here in front of you, but at least hopefully I motivated why you might get something non-trivial. It's because, well, this picture I drew here, when I put a hole in, well, that makes some energy there. But unless I want to make if I don't want to make energy all along the way, I have to have this just be a line. And you can, you know, so you write all this out in the dimer language. It's not hard to see. Okay, so now, all right, so that's the model. So I went through that quickly just to hopefully to try and motivate where that model was coming from. But now what we want to do is really find a Hamiltonian that has that as its ground state of physics. So we're trying to be honest here. We've got a Hilbert space, but we need a Hamiltonian, and I'm going to get that ground state. But it's really easy to find one for this. This is why Roxburgh and Kivelson set it up this way. So in my world, they call this a Roxburgh-Kivelson Hamiltonian. And what this is you write your Hamiltonian as a sum of projection operators. And I'll give you the explicit one on the next slide. But generically, a Roxburgh-Kivelson Hamiltonian is the sum of projectors. Okay, so projection operator just means some operator that squares to itself. Or have a constant there, it doesn't matter. So the sum of projectors, the only thing you need to say is these projectors are local. Like I said, I'll give you an explicit example in a second. And then the ground state, so it's easy to check though, when your Hamiltonian is this form, all the eigenvalues of this Hamiltonian have to be positive. And so thus, if you can find any state that's annihilated by all of these projection operators, then it must be a ground state, since all the eigenvalues, are either positive or zero, so non-negative. And so if you can find one annihilated by all these things, then it must necessarily be a ground state. That's the trick of the Roxer-Kivelson trick. And that's what we're going to do for this dimer model. So since I'm definitely in a place where there must be at least one quantum information person who wandered accidentally in here, in that world, those Hamiltonians are called frustration-free. And it's a good name in one sense because it means that all these projectors sort of all can behave nicely. There's one state that's annihilated by each one of these projectors individually. So it's each of those. So that's why they say it's frustration-free. They all cooperate. The confusing part comes from the condensed matter point of view because we have a different notion of what we need frustration. So actually, one of the interesting things about these Hamiltonians is you get them from models that have what we call their frustration. So to say it's frustration-free kind of says, well, except it's frustration-full, and then it becomes frustration-free. So that's confusing. So we just call them Roxer-Kivelson because, you know, they're nice guys, and why not name it after somebody? In an effort to bridge the gap between different fields, so we'll just call them free Hamiltonians, so FFRK. So we'll see. I don't think I'm going to get this to stick, but at least I'll try it on you guys. So we can call, for today at least, we will call Hamiltonians that can be written in this form free Hamiltonians. They are sort of freakish in a way, but they're all right. So now I'm going to do this for the quantum dimer model. I'm going to write down my free Hamiltonian, my Roxer-Kivelson Hamiltonian. This is exactly what they did. I say, okay, so I just can draw pictures. I mean, you can write all this out in terms of spins and sigmas and all that kind of stuff, but that's much less illuminating than just drawing a picture. All right, so say we have a plaquette. This is just a single plaquette on the lattice. So if you think about it, we have this rule that each site has to have one dimer touching it. So it's hard to make local moves. So the simplest way of doing something locally and not messing it up elsewhere is to take a plaquette which the two dimers on the given plaquette line up. And people call that a flippable plaquette. And the reason, because you can change this locally without changing anything else. You haven't messed up any of the other constraints. And so the Hamiltonian just now basically has two diagonal terms and two off-diagonal terms. Well, I guess four. Yeah, two diagonal terms and two off-diagonal terms. So it just says take that thing and send it to itself minus the flipped one. And the flipped one, you send it to itself minus its flipped one. And the projector then annihilates any other plaquette. So you have one projector for each plaquette. It just checks, are the two lined up? If they line up, it does this. If they don't line up, it just annihilates it. So the nice thing now is easy to check. If you take this linear combination, remember this is quantum mechanics, we've got linear combinations. You take linear combination, that plus that, this Hamiltonian annihilates this. So if you think now the ground state has to be this linear combination of all states with that plus that, but then I can flip that one and all that. And it's not too much work to show that within a given winding sector, the topology coming in again, within a given winding sector, you get all configurations. So it's the equal amplitude sum of all configurations within a given winding sector. I didn't put that on the slide, but that's important. So you can move through space just by flipping the things one at a time and get all the configurations up to a global conserved thing. So we already have an exact ground. So we have an exact ground state. So that's pretty great. But even we can do something even more. In fact, we can reduce the computation of any correlation function in that ground state to a computation in a classical model. So we're doing a 2D quantum model. I have a ground state, but I want to compute a correlation function in that ground state. And what I'm going to show you now is this computation actually can be done in a classical model. That's why these models are so well studied, because we can do stuff. All right, so this is my ground state. That's what I'm calling capital psi. And it's just the sum over every single dimer configuration in a given sector. Every dimer configuration with equal amplitude. So the thing I said at the beginning. All right, well, so we would compute the expectation of some operator. That the operator has to be diagonal on this dimer basis, but on that. So we do there. All right, so you say I'm treating, that's just the definition of what you mean by an expectation value of the operator. That's obviously not normalized, so I have to normalize my expectation value. All right, so this just says, you know, act on that and you sum over all that. But if you look at it now, this just says measure some quantity in a dimer state. You get some number out. So as long as O is diagonal, this just spits some number out. And then this just normalizes over all the possible configurations. Well, that's exactly what you would get if you were doing a computation in a classical dimer model. You say, well, are these two dimers lined up? Well, there's some in this given dimer configuration. They are or they aren't. And you would get one or zero. And then this would be the expectation value. So it's the exact same computation in a quantum and a classical system, which is a pretty amazing trick. So it's a two-dimensional quantum model, the ground state, but now I've reduced the computation of its correlators to a two-dimensional classical computation.
That is just because the operator is diagonal.
For the diagonal operators, right.
Why is it special to dimers, or why is it remarkable? Isn't it in any quantum system if the operator is diagonal?
No, of course not. It's a statement about the ground state of a two-dimensional quantum system. And I reduced it to a computation in a particular classical system that I know. It's a sum. I mean, of course, anything reduces to a number, right? Which then I guess I can call that number a classical system. But this is a specific classical system that, in fact, that's the next thing. That's all. Everything is known. So this is some classic work in statistical mechanics, 50 years ago, early 60s. Basically, all those correlators can be computed with closed forms. So, beautiful classic work that is still pretty awesome. So that's good. All right, so we can compute everything, and I'll say a little bit about what you get out, but there, even before I say what we get out, there's actually a complication. It's actually important. So, and this is kind of what sunk the whole thing in applying for high TC. So if you do this for the square lattice, the model I just wrote down, what you find from those classic results from Kastelein and Fisher in the early 60s, so we know all the correlators except they algebraically decay. So that says, in the classical dimer model, you have some probability. Do these two dimers line up, you know, and how does that fall off with distance? Well, it turns out that probability decays only algebraically, not exponentially. And that means in the corresponding quantum system, in fact, there's a theorem due to Matt Hastings, if that's true of the ground state in a quantum system, then the system must be gapless. And that's kind of bad for topological stuff because we want it to be gap, because then it's the sort of robustness of doing all the stuff is saved by the gap, because if you do things very weakly, you know, then you haven't put enough energy in the system to overcome the gap. So it's all protected. But if it's gapless, an arbitrarily small amount of energy can mess the system up. Whereas with the gap, you kind of can't do much with an arbitrarily small amount of energy. And so the fancier way of saying is this model is quantum critical, that when you go port this statement about the classical dimers back to the quantum system, it's algebraic confinement. But then, 10 years after that, circa 2000, yeah.
So, but forgetting this issue of energy and the gap,
yeah.
Can we turn around and ask what are all the class of relevant perturbations that?
Absolutely, yeah. And people have. It turns out it's the square lattice Roxer-Killson point is a peculiar multi-critical point. So not only it has actually two relevant perturbations, two relevant operators, which is sort of already bad because that means in a real system you'd have to fine-tune two things, and also an infinite number of dangerously irrelevant operators, you know, with that. So it's some peculiar, and the reason you can think of that heuristically, there's lots of ways of lining dimers up, having dimer order, and this special Roxer-Killson point is somehow this strange multi-critical point where all the orders manage to just join each other in this equal amplitude thing. So yeah, it's peculiar, but I mean, you can write down effective field theory for it and all that. It's, and even though it's peculiar, it's one of the few quantum critical points in 2+1 dimensions we actually understand. And so, but at least okay. So Right, but then, but for topological stuff, we want the gap anyway. Yeah, and sometimes we want it to be critical. I'm going to talk a lot more about that critical point, by the way. Yeah.
Are you in 3D XY? Is the universality class is 3D.
3D XY. No. It's a Z equals 2. In fact, I'll if I have time at the end, I can say more about that. No, it's a Z equals 2. It's not. It's in some pneumatic thing. This was actually studied, but because it's not in the 3D case, space and time wouldn't be. There's not a symmetry between space and time. This isn't the Lorentz invariant quantum model, so the corresponding 3D classical model won't be rotationally invariant in 3D space. But 10 years after Roxor Kivelson did this, and people kind of dismissed it because, we don't want something that's critical. You guys are idiots. Go away. And I mean, that was almost exactly the reaction. Well, actually, the reaction was ruder than that. If you ask, well, then they'll tell you. They'll tell you stories. But anyway. But then about 10 years after that, again, this issue what I said before, if you do something that's neat and profound, you should, instead of saying, I give up, it doesn't describe the cuprate superconductors, doesn't describe anything interesting, it maybe took 10 years for people to sort of think about different problems. But they said, let's do this on the triangle lattice. So Messner and Sonny said, do it on the triangle lattice. Now, for the cuprates, that's irrelevant. They're not on the triangle lattice, but we can think about the triangle lattice. In fact, then you get topological order. You get the gap. Correlators exponentially decay, and then the corresponding quantum model has this topological order. So that was this beautiful result of theirs about 10 years ago. And so in particular, the holons and spinons are deconfined, so that means you take them apart and they have a non-zero probability. So take the two-point function, which I can compute using the trick I just told you about, and they fall off to some non-zero, that falls off almost. So the naive value, the nearest neighbor value for the triangular lattice for the holon, so just putting two holes on, it should be 1/6, because there's basically just probability 1/6 of two things. And then you move far away and actually only drops off, you'll see on the next slide that it's 1.49. So essentially, they're completely deconfined. There's as much probability to find them a mile from each other as there is to find next to each other. And so, we actually computed this number. That computation is actually not so easy in the dimer language. It had been done for the square lattice, but nobody in the dimer world thought to do triangular lattice too, just because, nobody ever thought to do it. So we did it. I don't know. People know me. I like to do computation. So I got this. Again, there's this whole complicated story, and I was really mad that I couldn't evaluate this thing for the square lattice. There's this thing called Zagos theorem, and you can get that number analytically, but I couldn't figure out a version of Zagos theorem. And so I just put it on the computer one afternoon on my stupid little laptop, and it just crunched out till I got, I think I had like 10 or 15 more places too. But anyway, just to prove to the world that I was strong, at least I could set it up so that my computer could generate that number to pretty arbitrary accuracy. And so we did that. And so I gave a talk at Illinois on this. So this is now a long time ago now, but I tell this story because it's so great. So I give a talk, so a useful lesson for the students. Okay, so Mike Stone, who many of you may know, Mike says, did you try the inverse symbolic calculator? And I, of course, gave the predictable response, Mike, what is the inverse symbolic calculator? It's this thing, it's actually Simon Fraser up here in Canada. And so what it is, you plug in a number and it tells you if it's the combination of any fundamental constant. So after the talk, we went back to his office, I pulled out the paper and we typed in, I forget, the first 10 or 15 digits, and there you go. And now the sequel, of course, I've tried to do this every time I've had a number for the last 10 years. I've tried this and it's never worked once. So anyway.
It's the calculator from John Borwin.
Is that who wrote it?
I think so.
Okay. Yeah, it's a marvelous thing. It's just, I mean, there's all these theorems too. Like you can compute digits of pi in hexadecimal. You can compute any arbitrary digit of pi without computing the previous ones if you want the 100 millionth digit of pi. In hexadecimal, not in a thing, there's some formula for you. It's all this cute stuff that these guys did. Anyway, right, so I say, one hit wonder, but it's a pretty cool hit. So, at least I always thought so. And then later on, some mathematicians, so they told me at the time, I contacted some mathematicians I know and said, there's a cool result, but, Toeplitz and Hankel, I gave up. I couldn't do it. And they told me, you can evaluate that symbolically. And of course, I said, what does that mean? And that one they couldn't really explain to me. But then like 2 years later, they came back and handed me a formula, which is pretty amazing. So now this parameter T is, you can actually continuously interpolate between square and triangular lattices by adding just the probability. So you just make a square lattice into a triangular just by adding things across the diagonal, and you can make a probability for dimers to be on those. So you can, if T is zero, they're not there at all. T equals one, it's indistinguishable. Interlink, so you can do it continuously. And in fact, we did that in our paper, but we couldn't evaluate the answer. And after this horrendous computation, there's the answer for all T. And that's actually the dimer version of Onsager's famous formula for the magnetization of the Ising model. So that's an incredibly famous formula, deservedly so. It's one of the miracles of theoretical physics. This formula is actually easier than that formula. That involves elliptic theta functions. That's all there is to it, these guys do. And nobody knows about it. So that's why I still put this in my talk to plug these guys' work. Because anytime there's a simple formula, there's an axiom in physics, right? There's always a simple way to get it. And they didn't find the simple way, but they did get it. So maybe somebody can figure out how to do this. I've tried and I still.
So what's the XYZ model behind?
What?
You have XYZ model behind?
No, this is dimers, which is like, it's roughly akin to the Ising model off the critical. It's the same universality class as the Ising model. Actually, it's two Ising models with opposite sign mass terms. It's in the same universality class. In fact, that's in our paper too, explain how that is. But that's only a universality statement. This is an exact statement in the triangular lattice classical dimer model. Again, all this is for, you can do all these calculations in the classical dimer model.
So that's the gap, right?
Well, it's related to the gap. It's like a one-point function. Like I say, it's the probability that you know when you take one dimer off to infinity, what's the probability of a dimer? So obviously, it's related to the gap. The gap is related to how it would exponentially decay into this number. So it's not a universal number, but it's anyway. And by the way, so that you plug t equals one, and you can rewrite sine pi over 12 in terms of square roots of square roots. Okay, so that's a slight tangent, but I think that's still worth mentioning. So let's go back. So now go to a slightly more recent problem. So I mentioned when I introduced these dimers, I said, well, okay, we're cheating. We're making them orthogonal by saying these quantum dimer configurations are orthogonal to each other. The correct answer meaning, correct mean if you're really interested in the spins, not the dimers, well, then when you take two different quote dimer configurations, so I try to always put quotes on the dimers. So by quote dimer, I mean the spin single, the valence bond. Okay, now if I take two of those configurations, you can see that there's actually the same overlap I did before. You define loops by putting those two things on top of each other, and actually then the inner product of two different dimer configurations is number 2 to the number of loops. Oh, minus n, sorry. 2 to the number of loops minus n, so it gets smaller. So as the configurations get much more and more different, the loops get longer and longer, and so this gets suppressed. So, oh no, sorry, no. This is 2 to the number of loops. So this is bad from the dimer point of view, because not orthogonal we could probably handle, but it's non-local, because you have to decide whether these loops come around and touch each other again. It's kind of nasty. And again, so the statement, so that means it's gapless, again, for this. Any Hamiltonian you would write down, even without doing it. But then there was something observed, again, 20-something years ago when people were first thinking about these things. The spin-spin correlator exponentially decays. So that's easy. There's actually good, not an analytic proof, but an excellent, excellent analytic argument. And plus, they did numerics, which then we redid. And it exponentially decays in very quickly. So this is now something that doesn't exist in the dimer model, because now we're thinking the spins themselves as the degrees of freedom. Yes, what's the probability? If this spin is up, that spins up. Okay, and that probability decays exponentially very quickly. Okay, and then there's some recent numerical work, some very nice numerical work, where they show that there's no evidence of spin order. Okay, and this is a quantum system at zero temperature, and it's very strange to say. We have just local interactions among the spins. I'll show you a Hamiltonian in a second. And it doesn't order. I mean, yeah.
I thought the Liang Yuzhen Anderson paper, they recovered the staggered, the, is that for the square lattice there?
So we're just going to, so who, what paper are you referring to?
The same paper. That's their 1989 paper, right? Where they recovered that the staggered order parameter is non-zero?
Yeah, yeah. Oh, the staggered order? No. Well, if they did, I don't remember the old papers, but these guys did a really thorough job, and they couldn't find, I mean, so this is obviously not a proof, but they couldn't find it. But I would say, so in fact, the next thing, so first of all, there's now a question. So this, what these guys showed only numerically is that there's no local order parameter for the spins that you can find. So it's conceivable that the spins have a gap. This theorem applies only to the dimers, if you wish. So it's completely conceivable that anytime you have a spinful excitation, it may have a gap. We don't know one way or the other. We don't even have a Hamiltonian, so it's not yet even a question we can answer. But in particular, there's these phases called spin liquids, which are exactly analogs of this RVB state. You sum over, your ground state is a sum over a bunch of stuff. And in fact, experimentally, they look for these things, and you can find lots of papers in Science and Nature and PRL where they provide evidence for spin liquid. But in fact, the evidence is this. They go to very low temperatures in their system, and they don't see any order. And they say, well, therefore, it must be a spin liquid. So actually, the evidence, experimental evidence, is and the theoretical evidence for this one, anyway, are the same. There's other theoretical cases where we know there's spin liquid. But anyway, this case, at least it's plausible. But to answer that, a key thing now, is there a spin gap? So are there any spinful excitation? We can't even answer that. We still can't answer that question, but we can't even start to think about that question until we have a Hamiltonian, right? The gap is a statement about Hamiltonian. These other statements I've been making are about correlators in the ground state, or correlators in sort of excited states I make by hand by sticking a hole in them. To find a gap, we need a Hamiltonian. And so it has to be Hermitian. Hamiltonians need to be Hermitian in my world. And it needs to be local, because other non-local, you can do anything you want. And it needs to have this RVB state. So that's pretty non-trivial due to this funniness with the non-locality of the inner product if we rewrite the spins in terms of these dimers. But there is one. So Jen Kano, who's then my student, and I did this. And so I'll flash a slide, so I guess it'll be on the thing. Since I'm running late and there's some other stuff I want to say, maybe we'll talk about. So there's a procedure you do. It's kind of a mess. But if written out sufficiently simply, that's the most complicated part of the Hamiltonian. That looks not too bad. But these are projectors onto multiple spins, so this is actually an 8-spin interaction. But written out like this, it doesn't look so bad. But on the other hand, some people say they know how to use computers, so come on, it's just an 8-spin interaction. So tell me whether there's a gap. We wrote this paper a couple years ago now, and nobody's yet been able to find out, answer the question. Okay, does that Hamiltonian? Here's a Hamiltonian. Does it have a gap? It's a well-defined question. If the RVB state's the ground state, for appropriate boundary conditions, we can prove that it's the unique ground state. Say on a disk, it's the unique ground state, but does it have a gap? I think so. I hope so. Anyway, so if we can do that, so that's something to do. That's a challenge here. But we're waiting. So let's try and do something else with these models. And so again, let's now go back. And let's try now to understand the gapless behavior of this model. So we've got two models. We've got the quantum dimer model, and we've got the RVB model. They look if I draw the pictures, they look exactly the same, but they differ because of this inner product. We have Hamiltonians in both cases. It's all good. But then the question is, at least a question we can answer, I think, pretty convincingly, and so that's what I'll tell you about for the remainder of the talk, a question we can answer pretty convincingly, is the physics of the RVB wave function, the gapless physics, the same as that of the quantum dimer model, the square lattice quantum dimer model? And then the question again, so I can't answer this question, but actually that's a statement, but I put a question mark at the end to indicate that the statement, I don't know whether it's true or not, it's not a question. It's a statement with a question mark. So we know that you can make a spin liquid by perturbing the square lattice quantum dimer model by making this triangulosity, letting the moment you add any triangulosity, you gap the system and you get to a topological phase. So then the question is, by adding by basically allowing the dimers to break into spins. The quantum dimer model basically says you have nothing other than these dimers. But now break them into spins, it's actually a pretty small perturbation, you'll see with the results. I mean, there's some quantitative, but not really, at least we didn't find any qualitatively substantial differences between the two. Can you maybe get a spin to look at? So again, it's we don't know, but I think the stuff I'll tell you for the last 10 minutes will maybe at least hopefully convince you of that part, and then one can speculate about that part. There we go. Okay, so first evidence actually was already provided by the same guys who studied the spin stuff. So they studied the RVB thing, and they looked at the ground state itself, and then they looked at these algebraic decay correlators in the RVB. So quantum dimer, we can reduce it to something we can compute, because it's this classical model. It turns out it's the classical dimer model. We can compute anything we want there with enough work. But in the RVB case, we can reduce it to some classical thing, but it's non-local because of these loops and all that. So that one, we could in principle compute stuff by 2D classical numerics, but it's not known how to do that analytically. But so they did it numerically, and then they found this very convincing thing. In particular, the Tang, Sandvik, and Henley paper, they found a very convincing thing that, in fact, it's described, these correlators in the RVB state are described by what people call a Coulomb gas or a free boson. So that's already a good piece of evidence for the fact that it's the universality, and I'll explain more precisely what I mean by universality, because what we did now is we have a way to interpolate between the dimer model and the RVB model, so you can continuously interpolate. And in particular, then, you can then do what everybody's favorite thing is to do these days. Also, not only measure the entanglement entropy numerically, but compute it. We can compute it for the dimers, but then if you believe the universality, we have an answer for the RVB. Okay, so the way you now interpolate between dimers and RVB, instead of making everything spin singlets, we let the spins be SUN, so it's an N component spin, quote spin. But it's still, you then make it a singlet, and that just changes the inner product, and it's easy to check as you make n goes to infinity, they just turn into dimers. And so by setting n, and actually it's easy to set it up so n doesn't even have to be an integer, and not necessarily in the numerics, but at least analytically you can think of n continuously. And so we did that. We, being Haijin Zhu, and Roger, who did the Monte Carlos, and so this is now plotting the dimer-dimer correlation function in RVB. This is a numerical correlation directly in RVB. And just ask for the singlet-singlet correlation function and how it falls out with distance. And you plot it on a log-log plot. And at long distances, so that's this way, it clearly goes to a power law. This is a log-log plot. Now, off here, it varies, but that's a short-distance thing. And I'll say a little bit about more in a minute. But to ignore this for now, clearly, it's a thing. And so it matched for the SU2 case, what these other guys had done. But now this is 2, 3, 4, 5. And so 5, it still isn't numerically infinity, but it's close. So there's an exponent here. So it falls off algebraically. There's an exponent alpha. For dimers, it's exactly 2. By the time we got to 5, I guess it's 1.67. That's right here. I put a table. And so these are all the numerical values. So it's clearly algebraic. There's no doubt whatsoever. And at least it's heading toward 2. Now, 1.67 is still pretty far from 2. But there's a remarkable analytic result that showed how to expand things around the dimer case by Demley, Dar, and Romola, not about a year ago now. Not even a year ago. But anyway, so you have to fit some things. So they can only do first order, and then you have to kind of fit their parameter to n. So there's an unknown there. But once you do that, if you fit it by, say, fixing this value, because that's the best numerical determinant, then the other ones fall out. And you can see, even just keeping the leading term in their expansion, it agrees with those numbers. So all that's really good. OK, so and so we can, in fact, push this further. So I mentioned a few minutes ago, there's that upturn. And maybe we'd like to see, it would be really cool if we could see how that upturn, that short distance modification happened. And then, like I say, we love entanglement entropy here. Then you can actually do some computations. So since I'm running low on time, I won't tell you, I'll just give you the 30-second version. It turns out the classical dimer model, so let me make a statement about classical dimers, can be turned into a field theory. This is a well-known procedure. It even goes back to the early 80s. It's called the Coulomb gas approach. Henley worked this out for dimers in the mid-90s, but there was no particular reason why people couldn't have done it earlier. And so it's a more general procedure to describe models like dimers and many others, the XY model, classical XY model being a prominent example, the quantum XXE model being another, in terms of a free boson theory. And it has this same, the correlators fall off algebraically, but then there's a coupling constant in the theory. And so that's the thing there. In the language of the boson, it's called the stiffness. And so the correlators fall off with distance with an exponent depending on this coupling. And so then you can fix this coupling by fitting it with the dimer. So for the dimer value, that coupling has to be, turns out the normalization we use has to be, I guess, 1/2. But see, now we have this whole family of theories with this coupling kappa. And we can then hope now, so the more precise statement of the universality is that for any n, this parameter n that tunes between RVB and dimers, will correspond to some value of kappa. So we don't have an analytic way of deriving what it is, but it's some cap value of kappa. And so if that universality assumption is true, then we know all the correlators in the theory, just like we knew them for the dimer case. All the equal time correlators of diagonal operators in the dimer picture. So that's this precise statement of universality. And so we know everything. And so again, once we make that assumption, now this upturn in the data here, you actually, there's an answer. That depends on what specific theory, but for the free boson theory, there's a computation you can do in finite size. The answer is Jacobi elliptic beta functions, but anyway. So the numerical data gets kludgy enough, so you can't tell that this is the exact answer, but obviously it's the behavior is all correct. So that's a good sign for this universality for any n. Is this the equal time dimer correlators are described by these bosons. So now, entanglement entropy is everybody's favorite thing these days. And so we did that too, both numerically, but we can numerically too, because Roger has a tool bag of really clever ways of computing this numerically. But in the dimer case, we can actually compute it exactly. And there's a trick due to Stefan Mizuguchi and Pascal. Stefan is now my postdoc and my collaborator on this project. But before that, he wrote this marvelous paper where they showed a way of basically, just like we reduced the computation of the correlation functions to this thing kind of one-dimensional lower, in some situations here, unfortunately not for RVB, at least they don't know how to make it work, but for quantum dimers, it does work. You can reduce this 2D quantum computation to essentially a 2D classical or a 1+1D. Quantum computation, one dimension lower. Anyway, and there it's just the Shannon entropy. So that's a marvelous result. And so he did the computation there. And so the entanglement entropy we used, so put in a plug for this. So this is a great geometry to do entanglement entropy for gapless systems. Our space-time, it didn't come out very well, is a torus, because numerical people like tori. Actually, analytic people like tori. We all like tori. Because they like it because it's easier to do things, and we like it because you can write nice formulas down. And so then you divide your torus into two cylindrical regions. So that's region A, region B, and then you compute the entanglement entropy. But the reason why this geometry is really cool and useful for a gapless system is because the boundary length is independent of the size of the cylinders. I can make the cylinders bigger and smaller without changing the boundary length. And if you've studied entanglement entropy, you know that stuff depends on the size of the boundary. But we can vary the size of the region without changing the boundary, so none of that stuff will change, and then we have a probe to what's going on in the region. Now, in a gap system, this is useless because everything falls off exponentially, so it won't matter the size of the region. But for a gapless system, this matters a great deal. And so that's the geometry we did. And indeed, we found something interesting. So this is for the SUN. Okay, so this is, which one's 2, 3, 4? 2, 3, 4. And we find this even odd effect. So this is really striking. If you've looked at entanglement entropy, in fact, there's a theorem that seems to forbid this. Depends on the size of the region, whether the region is even length or odd length. The result jumps dramatically. Now you can see these are the odd ones. The odd ones form what look like a fairly smooth curve. The even ones form a smooth curve. But there, so that was a paper with Roger and Ann, who's here too, and we observed that first and then did more work later on. And so if you know something about entanglement entry, this seems to violate what's called strong subadditivity, which says that this thing must be concave, convex, one or the other. And well, one of these is concave and the other is convex. So whatever the theorem says, we violate it. But we don't violate the theorem because the theorem only applies the von Neumann entropy, and this is what's called the second Renyi entropy. So there's no theorem, and indeed, it doesn't happen. Okay, so there's Jean-Marie did this computation. So that's the answer. Those are elliptic theta functions. They're not scary. They're on Mathematica or Maple. You just put them in. Those are all the properties there. And what's matter, you can do the computation. You can see the difference between odd and even. And in the bosonic language, it's because something becomes twisted. So if you're familiar with bosons, then you won't be surprised that the partition function changes. And moreover, this is now true. I'm running out of time. So this is only true for the Renyi index being greater than a certain value. There's a phase transition in the Renyi index. All right, so now this is for the dimer. So the curves there are the exact curves, those formulas. You just plug them into Mathematica. And then this is numerical data, not from Monte Carlos, but from the dimers directly. And you see, it's pretty good, although the finite size effects are pretty large. We could go to larger systems in some special case, and we checked that the agreement is perfect. But even for reasonable size systems, they're obviously noticeably off, but you can see clearly that they're converging. So this is now for RVB, where we don't know the exact answer. Oh, sorry, this one's still dimers. And again, you can see this transition I mentioned before. This one's for RVB now. And so there you can see, obviously, it's not converged. So this is just the different size systems. But you can see it's clearly heading to there. Now, where these curves came is not from the formula I wrote down before. That was for dimers. But you can now redo the computation for different values of that parameter kappa I gave and get more theta functions where kappa is a parameter. And so just like for the critical exponents, you can fit it. Well, OK, so this isn't really a fit because the finite size effects are too large. But very clearly, it's heading in the right direction. So that, I think, provides coupling the two together. I think that's pretty convincing evidence that there's universality. And since now I'm out of time, I won't go. But let me just say one more thing. Well, I won't show any more slides. But you can actually, so I just showed you the classical 2D theory. But you can actually apply all of this to the full quantum two-dimensional theory. So I was talking about relating the ground state and then doing 2D classical computations. But actually, in this particular case, you can do a full 2D quantum theory. The model's called the quantum Lifshitz model these days. And, well, you can compute some more stuff. But anyway, since I'm out of time, we'll tell you about that. But anyway, thanks for your attention.
Okay, thanks for a great talk. Questions, anyone? Questions about the amazing numerics that you saw? Questions about...
Yeah, it's Ralph.
You said something on this stuff that's related to the twist of the boundary on your free board. Can you comment on that?
Yeah, so there's two things. So for Renyi index large enough, the computation, basically the boundary conditions end up being fixed. So it amounts to the product of the computation of the entropy amounts to the product of the partition function on sort of two cylinders. So it's not a sum anymore. It's just a product of the two cylinders because this particular thing works out. And so then you just have to compute a cylindrical partition function. Well, when you do this mapping from the dimers to the field that I basically didn't talk about that went over too quickly, you see that the difference in value of the phi, the field phi, depends crucially on whether there's an odd or an even number of sites in the system. Basically, it's shifted by one if there's an odd number of sites, and it's the same if it's not. And so when you then go to the continuum theory and compute this, the fact that it's shifted by one between top and bottom gives you a different answer and turns one upside down when you just do the computation, turns one upside down. And
And so that's why the upper one is, yeah, that's the odd one, is upside down. So yeah, that's, so I mean, actually there's, I mean, there's obviously more details, but conceptually that's basically what there is.
Yeah. Maybe I don't understand, but can you explain physically why this happens?
So, sorry, why?
The even on effect, yeah. Do you have an answer?
Well, so yeah, well, the okay, so if you're just looking at like correlators, there can be very strong even odd effects in correlators because the dimer has this sort of very natural even odd thing going because it's a geometric object, it's extended. So for example, the fall off in just the classical dimer model, the fall off in correlators depends very crucially whether an even or an odd number of sites apart. I mean, so that's at least not, we at least hope that's at least plausible that that's true. So that's why initially when we saw this, I said, what's the big deal? I mean, it happens for the correlators. Why shouldn't it happen here? But then there's all these theorems and says stuff like this doesn't happen. But see, somehow when you look at these higher Remy entropies, so in the von Neumann, this won't happen. And so somehow the average, it washes out the even odd effect in the entanglement entropy typically. And that's people's intuition. But somehow they look in these higher ones, allows that effect to come through. So that's not a great explanation, but that's the best one I have.
You also had it for higher SUN,
right? Yeah, so I have two n, I have little n and big. Little n is the Renyi index, sorry. I should use alpha for Renyi. You know, why did we use n? I don't know. We should have used alpha. So yeah, that n is the Renyi index, which I didn't even define because I started going quickly. If you know what that is, there's different entanglement entropies parameterized by a continuous parameter, and alpha equals one is the usual von Neumann one. So there's a transition that, and in fact, one of our points is there's no transition in N because I'm trying to say that the dimers and the RVB, SU2 RVB are sort of continuously connected just by varying N. Yeah, so thanks for clarify that one. But the transition is in the Renyi index, let's call it alpha now. And so somehow when you get high enough, it actually gets better because it's sensitive. Now it doesn't wash out, so this is good. It doesn't wash out that even odd physics that seems sort of natural in the dimer. So anyway, that's a good news. Higher Renyi entropies are good. That's maybe one moral I should have, could have had a conclusion of morals.
Okay. So did you check whether your ground state was dimerized in any way? When you were in the cylinder, you look at this even odd effect.
That it's dimerized. No, so the ground state, so these guys do the simulations directly on the ground state. I mean, right. It's the RVB state.
There's no Hamiltonian, so.
There's no Hamiltonian. It's just the RVB state.
Right. So that state is, you are not in one sector that has dimerization or anything.
You can restrict it to a winding number sector.
Yeah.
But there's no restriction to any dimerization.
What I mean is the first suspicion would be that this ground state was not translational in matter.
Yeah.
I don't know.
Oh no, but it is by because they put in a translation in very ground state.
No, but if he's in both, that's why I'm suspicious.
Yeah.
So actually, if you do bring
does the mic pick that one up?
Yeah.
Or you know,
so if you do break translational symmetry, which I just learned this morning, like the VBS phase, you also get something like this.
Right.
So if you have a Hamiltonian that gives you like a VBS, you will also see an even odd effect. But in this case, you see it regardless. Even though you don't have any symmetry break.
So there is no symmetry breaking in the wave function, nevertheless, you have this. Okay.
Oh, I see. And we have an analytic, and if you don't believe Roger, we have an analytic result the RVB you can argue, but the dimers, that's an analytic result. I mean, and checked thoroughly numerically as well.
So it's still message that dimer wave function and the spin RVB state. Are in the same
universality. Well, their gapless behavior is in the same universality class. That's right.
Single effect.
Yeah. That's like
equal time.
Yeah. I say I'm convinced of that. I'm convinced by that.
The same kappa? Or?
No, so the kappa will depend on n. No, so they won't be the same kappa.
Okay.
So quote unit, well, yeah, I mean, how you want to call it. So it's like the usual XY story, you know, you have a continuously varying thing. So it's quote, same with a different value of kappa. So that does change the critical exponent. So those will, like that, those things I showed, that you can't tell, but they're tilting as you.
So So what is the, is there a field theory, 2 plus 1 dimensional field theory that captures those?
Yeah, there's quantum Lipschitz theory that I kind of ran out of time that captures exactly that. And there's a critical line. Well, wait, so I'll show you a phase diagram. I won't tell you what, there's a phase diagram. And this is a more general model now. And then this would live along this critical line there.
Is it D equal to?
That's equal. So yeah, in fact, the thing I was going to get to, I didn't, but now that I put a flash, this line is not z equals 2, and we don't understand this line very much at
all. So along the red line.
Yeah, the red line, but everything I talked about today is that. I was going to end with this exciting unknown thing, what's going on over here.
And kappa changing continuously.
And kappa is changing continuously. And then there's like a KT transition.
And dimer and spin IVV are 2 points on that.
Yeah, the critical part of the RVB. I'm arguing then the spin part is somehow, which isn't present there, that might be a gapped.
Is this spin with some kind of gauge thing?
Well, this is just some kind of Z2 lattice gauge theory, but you know. Oh, sorry, U1. I mean, it's U1. Yeah. Sorry, this was done by Fradkin and Kivelson 20 years ago. Again.
Z equal to U1.
Yeah, Z equals to U1. Yeah, right. The dimers are, see, even though they look, they square lattice dimers, even though they look like they're just Z2, actually then turn out to have a hidden U1. So it's really
is
U1.
Is there a way to understand how U1 appears?
Yeah. So this is what Fradkin and Kivelson did 20 something years ago. And then Messner, Sani, and Fradkin kind of rewrote it in more, I guess now modern line, now 10 years old language. Yeah, so I can show you the paper. So that's at least qualitatively very well understood why that's a U1 gauge. The square lattice quantum dimers is a U1 gauge.
And kappa corresponds to what?
I don't know. So what they were doing is just dimers. So that's a particular value of kappa, a half in my conventions. I don't think anybody's actually studied it along that whole. If anyone has, I don't know it. So the gauge theory along the whole line, I don't think has been studied. Eduardo's the right person to ask about.
The known thing is 1 point.
One point, the dimer one. I mean, yeah, I would think that stuff would not change that much, but yeah, it's a good question. What's kappa in the gauge theory? All right, we should ask Eduardo. I don't know. If anyone knows, Eduardo will, but I don't know.
Okay, so we're 5 minutes from competing with free beer time.
Yeah, so.
Probably, unless there's some quick questions, let's wrap it up and thanks. Thank Paul again.
All right. Thank you.